One, two, three, testing. That sounds fine. Today's date is, I think it's March 31st, 1983.
Yes.
I'm with Admiral Adams at his home out of Sydney. My name is Chris Bell, and we're going to talk about life in the Navy between the wars. And Admiral Adams was just telling me about how he got into the Navy. He had been a student at the Naval College before he graduated, before it folded, and the assortment of jobs he had in BC, tugboat, fisherman, and he had just started to tell me about him joining up, being asked by the Royal Canadian Navy to join up on a permanent basis in 1928.
That's right.
What did you do, sir? Did they retrain you?
Yes, I was had a couple of months' experience in the old destroyer Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And then I was sent off to England to do sub-lieutenant's courses, in spite of the fact I was a lieutenant. So I went to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich.
Before we get there, sir, let's talk about your few months on the West Coast in the Vancouver. What kind of ship was she like?
Oh, she was immaculately clean. Mm-hmm. Very small.
She was steam, she wasn't coal.
No, she was steam, yes. Steam turbines. And she was capable of about 30 knots.
Mm-hmm.
And she carried four-inch guns and four torpedo tubes.
Did you have torpedoes for the tubes?
Oh, yes. We had to. We used to practice with practice heads.
Now, tell me a little bit about the officers. How many officers were there on board? And what specific function did you have?
Well, there was the Commander Agnew,
mm-hmm.
And then the first lieutenant was Lieutenant Holmes, who is now Captain Bill Holmes, and then there was myself as another officer. We had an engineer officer and a gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Gunner was promoted up from the ranks as a warrant officer, and that was it.
So that was the entire wardroom?
Yes.
What kind of accommodations would you have on the Vancouver?
Oh, each officer had a small cabin.
Really?
And overhead was a bathtub, which was hoisted up to the ceiling, upside down. And when we wanted to have a bath, it was lowered down onto the deck. And
each officer had a bathtub?
Each officer had his own bathtub. It was, I would say, about 7 inches deep,
mm-hmm.
And hardly big enough to sit in, but we managed to keep ourselves moderately clean.
I imagine with salt water, no fresh water baths.
No, it would be a fresh water bath.
Really?
Yes.
Would there be fresh water condensers on board?
Yes, there were.
Mm.
And
well, about your quarters, your room itself, your cabin, how large was it, and what would be inside of it?
Well, there was a bunk 6 feet long across this on the alongside the ship's side,
mm-hmm.
And then there was the rest of the cabin would probably be 8 feet in length,
mm-hmm.
Which include a bed and a desk and a wardrobe for clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't swing a cat in it.
That sounds better than better than the men's quarters. I think they had hammocks in those days still.
Oh, yes. They were all men. They all lived in hammocks.
Mm-hmm.
And they stowed their hammocks when they got up in the morning in the hammock netting and strung them up when they wanted to go to bed.
Mm-hmm. Did they have I can remember reading something about Nelson saying that they would have to have 18 inches space for each hammock on board. Were they the same in the Royal Canadian Navy?
Well,
a little bit more, perhaps.
I don't recall ever having heard it described in measurement. But they all packed in, and they were happy.
Mm-hmm.
Very happy crews.
Well, tell me a little bit about the wardroom. How large was it? What did you have in it?
The wardroom would be full width of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
About, I would think, 14 feet fore and aft measurement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And in that there were easy chairs and a fireplace.
A fireplace?
Yes.
A working fireplace?
Yes. And we burned coal in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't be used in bad weather when we had to take the smokestack down. The Charlie Noble was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a dining room table, settees at each end. It was very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Did you each have a servant, or were there servants assigned to the wardroom itself?
There were two stewards who looked after the catering and serving of meals,
mm-hmm.
together with an officer's cook who shared the galley space with the cooks for the men.
Mm-hmm.
And to do our cabins and that kind of thing, we employed an able seaman's servant, who was paid 10 cents a day,
mm-hmm.
by the government. We usually paid another 10 cents out of our own pockets,
mm-hmm.
which we could ill afford, of course.
Oh, what was your pay in those days, if you don't mind my asking?
$5 a day,
mm-hmm.
$150 a month. And that was for a junior lieutenant. After 4 years, he got a raise of 50 cents, and then another 50 cents at 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 years, of course, he became a lieutenant commander with a gross pay of $7.50 a day.
What sort of expenses would you have out of that $5 as a junior lieutenant? Just pick your uniform, I assume.
Well, you had to pay a mess bill. Our food was not the general issue.
No.
It was catered to by the chief steward, and we had to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the government gave us a credit for what it would have cost had we lived off the general issue.
Mm-hmm.
That was in vogue at the time, but it soon became redundant, and the officers all went on general mess because the general mess improved so much.
Mm-hmm. But didn't the government in the 1920s increase the allowance that they would give for food?
Oh yes, they
did. Improve.
Yes, it was pretty light rations. Originally.
Mm-hmm. The sort of foods, I suppose, that would keep on board ship.
Yes.
Before refrigeration and other methods to...
Yes, that was true. All we had in Vancouver was an icebox.
Really?
Which meant we could save meat for 5 or 6 days.
And I suppose when you went on a cruise, say to the Caribbean or something, you wouldn't have that, would you?
No. We soon ran out of fresh food.
Though I guess if you were with Royal Naval ships and they had refrigeration, they would give you some.
Well, these ships were ex-Royal Navy,
mm-hmm.
and in those days they weren't equipped with the refrigeration.
No, they were the same as the RCN ships.
Yes. Of course, refrigeration in those days was not... people didn't have refrigerators in their houses.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. And iceboxes.
Well, let me ask you about wardroom life. You would spend most of your off hours there on board ship, wouldn't you?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes.
What sort of activities would you have?
Well, we used to roll the dice a lot and talk, and one was always busy in a ship. There was always something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there weren't those long periods in the wardroom. If you'd had middle watches or night watches, you'd probably sleep in the afternoon in one of the easy chairs. But it was very comfortable, really.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great life. Were there any games? I know in the Air Force at the time, bridge was a very a major social function for them. Did you have a comparable game?
No, I don't think. I don't recall ever having played bridge in the destroyer, although I played a lot of bridge in cruisers later on.
When it was larger.
Yes,
crew.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about any specific kind of regulations pertaining to messing or eating in the wardroom? Any rules you had to follow, toasts that had to be applied every night? Or?
No. There are, of course, when we dined, depending on the day, there was a toast of the day, and the most exciting of which was to sweethearts and wives mm-hmm. on Saturday night at sea, and in which case the president proposed the toast, or at least he asked the most junior member of the wardroom to propose the toast to sweethearts and wives.
You were the junior member, weren't you?
Yes, at that time, but we never dined at sea in a destroyer.
Never?
No.
It was always sort of informal food between watches.
Yeah, you had to be in a cruiser or battleship to find a dining at night.
Mm-hmm. And I guess because Canada didn't really have anything larger than a destroyer between war period, you didn't encounter anything like that?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's safe to say that it was fairly informal as to regulations in the mess, the dining.
Oh, yes, yes. It was entirely up to us what we did.
Yeah.
So and there were no specific regulations that controlled it.
Mm-hmm. I would guess that most regulations anyways were derived from the Royal Navy. Anything that was in the RCN.
Yes, that is very true. We were awfully close to the Royal Navy. Everything we did was done Navy fashion, which was the way it was done in the RN. Of course, all our officers had left the Naval College and gone to England to serve in battleships or something as midshipmen.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became dyed-in-the-wool British. We had to pattern ourselves after somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the Royal Navy was obviously the right place for it.
Well, it was still the world's largest, most efficient navy. It had fought with the Canadian Navy in the first war in convoy duty and whatnot, and so many British people in Canada anyway.
Yes.
And the ships were British, so why not maintain the tradition?
I think the main factor, of course, was that midshipmen were trained there. And we trained them in the college, and then immediately they went to Royal Navy
ships.
Battleships or cruisers.
How would you compare the early professionalism that you saw in the Royal Canadian Navy to that which you saw later when you transferred or you were assigned to the Royal Navy? Did they compare professionally?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You couldn't tell one from another by his professional behavior.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, they were all very efficient. I think if there's any criticism of the officers between the wars, is that they didn't have opportunity to get further training.
Yeah.
We should have realized that our role was anti-submarine, but how can you practice anti-submarine when you have no submarines?
Mm-hmm. We had some though, didn't we? I know that McBride bought a couple of them, but didn't they scrap them right?
Well, they lasted for a while in Esquimalt. But they were originally belonged to McBride. He bought them from Moran Shipyards in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I think they were being built for Chile.
They were, yeah.
And McBride bought them. And we had Canadian officers serving in them.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they were scrapped, of course.
I guess they became outdated, didn't they?
Well, the story goes that they were here to protect the Esquimalt against the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower or something or other was coming in the Straits.
Well, those two were the Rainbow, I think.
Yes. And they had no torpedoes for them. So it was pretty...
I suppose they could have rammed the ships. What about... I know you were only in Victoria on the Vancouver, the HMCS Vancouver, for a short period. But what sort of shore installations were there in Esquimalt at the time? Was it fairly much like it is today in size?
Yes, the dockyard was decidedly smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And the dockyard originally, when the Naval College was in operation, the only thing in the dockyard, apart from a few stores and a small machine shop, all the rest of the buildings were occupied by the Royal Naval College of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So the dockyard wasn't very
extensive at the time.
Extensive.
Now you would be living right on board the Vancouver while you were assigned to her. You wouldn't have quarters on a shore at the time, would you?
No, that's true. That was where all your belongings were, and you lived on board.
Would there be any sort of large, and I'm probably using the wrong term again, but I don't want to call it a wardroom, but would there be a large mess at Esquimalt for officers to meet in and socialize in from other ships?
Not in those days.
No.
Except that in Naden, where the present site is, there was a wardroom there.
Okay.
Within the present time, it's across the road, up behind the football field.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it was an old brick building, and it was sufficient to look after all the officers that we had.
Mm-hmm. Were you free to go in, anyone from any ship?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you were always welcomed on board, but you're always recognized as a visitor.
Well, tell me a little bit about that, too, because I'm interested in it, the building itself. Was that part of the building that had been a hospital at one time?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
It was
a Royal Navy hospital, yes.
Yes, it was Royal Navy.
Yeah. I've seen photographs of it, I think. What was it like?
It was very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Good dining room. Not large. And there were about 14, 15 officers that made use of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, was dining there somewhat more regimented than it was on board ship? Like, would you have rules that you'd have to follow there?
No, it'd be identical. The only rules that it applied to mealtime or when everybody was dressed up in bow tie and so on. And then the rules, the guiding and dinner are pretty extensive. Very, very sensible and very basic.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of those practices or the traditions were accepted by the VR, the Volunteer Reserves, during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it into a bit of a farce.
Mm-hmm.
The dinners are rather schmozzle and lacking in dignity.
Well, what I'm comparing it to is the Army and Air Force life. And that Air Marshal Dunlap, for example, has sort of given me extensive information about the rules and regulations that pertained to every meal that was attended at the mess, that one had to toast the king at the time, various toasts, and as to dress, as example, cocktails. There were two cocktails one could have before dinner. You couldn't have anything else. It was either a martini or a Manhattan.
Yeah.
One couldn't deviate from that at all. But I suppose it was different in the Navy, because in the Air Force and the Army, your life is completely centered around that shore-based mess.
Yes.
Whereas in the Navy, you're rather transitory.
Yeah. Well, the Air Force didn't have the same connection with the Royal Navy or our Royal Air Force as we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taught the rules of the RN, and they were brought to Canada automatically, just accepted. And there were no specific guides laid out except on this occasion of a formal dinner, which naturally in a ship can't happen every day.
Well, let me ask you another question. Perhaps it's a bit off base. Were women allowed on board ship and in the wardroom?
Oh, yes.
There was no rules against that?
No. Except in certain ships where the captain had a thing against having women on board.
Did that ever
which,
happen?
Which I've had experience of. But normally, the officers were very aware of the fact that you can't have women on board at sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and but we felt perfectly free to invite one at an appropriate time. We gave cocktail parties and dined the wives and so on.
Mm-hmm. Were most of the officers married? Or most of them single?
Well, most officers were married a bit late in life.
Mm-hmm.
I would say an average age for officers to marry would be probably 29 or 30. Couldn't afford to do otherwise.
Yeah. Were the regulations, though, to keep them from marrying? Because I know in the Army, one couldn't marry before, or at least in the Air Force, pardon me, one couldn't marry before one either became a flight lieutenant or until they reached the age of 30.
Yes.
And the idea was that you couldn't maintain yourself as an officer and a gentleman on the salary of anyone younger or
yeah.
lower rank than that. So they were effectively barred from marrying young.
There were no such rules in the Navy.
No.
You could get married whenever you wanted, and it was up to you to finance it.
Mm-hmm.
I personally couldn't afford to get married before I was 29. I was 30, as a matter of fact.
And that, well, let's progress here. You went to the Royal Navy for a bit. How long were you there?
I was there 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Royal Naval College of Greenwich, where we studied French and chemistry and physics. So on all the useful subjects.
Would you have been older than the rest of the students there?
I was, yes.
I
was a lieutenant of no seniority. And they were all sub-lieutenants in the Royal Navy. There were about 50 in our class. All sub-lieutenants except myself.
Mm-hmm. How did you fit in then, or did you fit in?
Oh, I fitted in very well. The great thing about life in the Royal Navy was that they paid great attention to games and sports and
mm-hmm.
physical training, and that was right up my alley.
And if you fit it in that
funny.
Way, yeah, I guess you're all right.
We used to play rugby for the Royal Naval College of Greenwich at the field, which is longitude zero,
mm-hmm.
right alongside of
the hill.
The observatory, which marks longitude zero.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to play rugby. It never affected our rugby game much that I noticed. But, we engaged in all kinds of sports
mm-hmm.
and games. And we drove all over England to play games, and mostly in private cars, all of which were open in the dead of winter and kind of miserable.
Well, when did you get back to Canada?
I came back to Canada in HMCS Skeena,
mm-hmm.
which was built at Thornycroft, Canadian design for Canada.
This was the Skeena and the Fraser, I guess.
No, the Skeena and the Saguenay
oh.
were the first two. And they were beautiful ships. They were modern and they were very capable ships. Had 4.7-inch guns, torpedo tubes, so on. They were beautifully built and beautifully maintained.
Well, the thing was, they were the first ships ever built for Canadians to
yes.
Canadian specifications. That was the big thing about those two ships.
We sailed from England in company with Saguenay. We were the first two destroyers ever to have crossed the Atlantic from Halifax to, or from England to Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't enough fuel oil to do that. Previous destroyers had to get some oil on the way, either at St. John's, Newfoundland, or from a tanker.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were you posted? You were posted to the Skeena as what?
I was the navigator.
Mm-hmm. With the rank of?
Lieutenant. You do 8 years as a lieutenant. So I wasn't promoted to lieutenant commander until 1936.
Did you stay on as navigator of the Skeena?
Yes, for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
We came to Halifax with the Saguenay, where we dropped Saguenay off. And independently, we came down through the canal and up to Swamout. and then we stayed in Esquimalt until the spring cruise, where we go back to the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
We did one trip in the Skeena, which was 29 or 30, I'm not sure, which we got stopped when we were passing San Salvador, El Salvador, and there was a revolution going on in El Salvador, and we went into a little port called Acajutla. You're going to ask me to spell it.
No.
And we had the Vancouver with us, so we sent her down to another port called La Libertad.
Mm-hmm.
It was a British railroad that ran from Acajutla up to the town of Salvador and down to La Libertad. And we went in there specifically with orders to protect this railroad.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the Monroe Doctrine, we were a little leery about landing. But I landed with a company of sailors, and we got some railway cars and barricaded them with sandbags, ready to take off. But I was constantly on the telephone with my captain, who was in Salvador. And they didn't progress beyond that. But it was a terrible revolution. There was no such thing as secret ballot.
No.
In the country, and anybody who voted the wrong way was taken out and
shot
and burned in the gutters. It was terrible.
Things haven't changed much in that country.
It appears not.
No. Wasn't Admiral Hibbert there at the same time? Because I think I heard a tape of him talking about the same revolution.
Yes.
Was he in Vancouver?
He was in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yes, he was in Vancouver at La Libertad, so we didn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But they did the same thing as we did. Landed men ready to take the train up to Salvador to rescue the
British Nationals.
British Nationals. We had six women come on board, and they took our cabins, and we slept on the upper deck.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept them on board for about 4 or 5 days when things were pretty dicey in there. But their husbands didn't. Their husbands were British, and they were mostly natives,
mm-hmm.
and speaks no English. And they stayed on board for 4 or 5 days, as I said. And then things quietened down, and they declared martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent them back to their homes. But it was a terrible thing to. We went ashore one day to have a swim, and a bunch of vultures rose off the beach and flapped away. We went up to see what they were feeding on, and there were two bodies. They'd been killed and pushed over the cliff and landed on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
It was dreadful, dreadful to watch.
Let's change the subject and talk about the ship itself, the Skeena. How did she compare to the Vancouver?
Oh, she was much superior.
Mm-hmm.
Much superior. She was bigger and very much more capable from every point of view. Her facilities were better.
Mm-hmm.
And we had refrigeration and so on. She was a real, real ship.
How about accommodations and wardroom? I'm interested in the social side of this. That's why I'm asking about quarters and whatnot. Were they bigger, larger than on the Vancouver?
Yes, they were a little bigger because we had more officers.
How many now?
Well, we had a first lieutenant, torpedo officer, and a navigator, and a gunner T, and an engineer commander.
Mm-hmm.
So we had one extra officer. The captain, of course, had his own quarters.
Mm-hmm. And again, you each had a cabin of your own?
Oh, yes, yes. Which were a little bigger, not much bigger. We didn't need to have them any bigger.
Not really.
No.
Was there a bathtub in the Skeena as well?
Oh, no. We had a proper bathtub up on the upper deck.
Did you?
Yes. There was a proper bathrooms and so on. Shoes.
Well, had there been good lavatories in the Vancouver?
Well, the officers had one head,
mm-hmm.
which was on the upper deck. Of course, you lined up for that on occasion. But the Skeena had better facilities all the way around.
Mm-hmm. It was a modern warship, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. It was completely modern. Unfortunately, she was lost in Iceland. She anchored and got blown ashore.
Mm-hmm. It was quite a loss when it happened, too.
Oh, yes. Terrible loss. Not only was there the sentimental value held by a lot of us, but we needed destroyers, especially good destroyers like the Skeena. She wasn't, when we bought her, she wasn't fitted with sonar, or ASDIC as we called it in those days, but later she was equipped with a sonar dome.
Did you spend any time on the East Coast?
Oh yes, a lot of the time on the East Coast.
Well, tell me about the onshore facilities at Halifax and other.
Well, originally the facilities weren't so great from the personnel point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But during the war, for the first 20 months of the war, I was a commander of Stadacona, the barracks there. And during that time, we were in pretty limited quarters in the dockyard, which had been the old Naval College, which blew up in 1917. And we managed to exchange with the Army. I don't know what we gave them, but they gave us the barracks up above on the... I've forgotten the name of their barracks originally, but Stadacona moved in there and built some very fine buildings for accommodation, which improved all the way through. Originally, we recruited so many men that we didn't have any accommodation for them, and they went on a lodging and compensation allowance. And we had no disciplinary control over them.
No.
At that time.
Were there many bases aside from Halifax on the East Coast of any note, any naval bases?
Oh yes, there was a base at Shelburne on the furthest.